Rusty Young was in his 20s when he went with his partner at the time to South America. He was travelling through Bolivia when he heard about a prison called San Pedro. San Pedro was a most unusual jail. Behind the high walls, there are no guards. The prisoners live with their wives, their children, and their pets. There are restaurants and shops. The prison can work well for you, but only if you have money. You have to buy a cell at San Pedro. The rich prisoners can afford running water, kitchens, and proper bedding. The poorest prisoners in San Pedro are crammed together into tiny, tiny cells. And at night, there's rampant drug use. Rusty Young went on an illegal tour of the jail that was being run by a British prisoner named Thomas McFadden, who was in for smuggling cocaine. Rusty wrote a book about his time in San Pedro with Thomas that was called Marching Powder, and it became a bestseller. Afterwards, Rusty went to live in Colombia for a while, and for 4 years, he secretly worked for the US government in counterterrorism. And in this role, Rusty got to know some of Colombia's child soldiers. These are kids who were caught up in the country's civil conflicts and the ongoing drug wars. Rusty's new book is called Colombiano. Hi, Rusty.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me on the show.
These are two big stories we're going to ask you to tell today in two different countries in South America. What drew you to South America in the first place?
I just finished my law degree and I was travelling with my then-girlfriend Simone Camilleri, and we just wanted to have a break before we went into the workforce, and it just seemed like an exotic place to go, very much off the radar for Australian travellers, and it's becoming more and more popular now. But it was just like, let's go somewhere where we've never, you know, we know nothing about Bolivia.
And what, you went around the whole of South America, or did you just Bolivia at this stage?
The initial aim was to go around the whole of South America, but it's a massive continent, and it would be impossible to cover the whole continent in one trip. But we went to Bolivia, Ecuador, and Peru, and then later on I went and moved to Colombia.
What had you heard about this prison in Bolivia?
As we were approaching the biggest city in Bolivia, which is called La Paz, all the other backpackers and travellers were talking about this prison that you could go and visit in La Paz, and you could go and do a guided tour. And I was just like, why would you want to go into a prison whilst you're on holidays, and particularly not in a poor developing nation where potentially, you know, it might be violent? But everyone assured us that it was completely safe and absolutely fascinating. You go up to the gates, you hand your passport over. That's their collateral that you're going to come out.
Right. I'm still not reassured by this at this stage.
It was rather intimidating. So you hand your passport over, and then they just open this big metal gate, and then it clangs shut behind you, and then you're in the middle of a prison. And the difficulty for me was that the prisoners don't wear uniforms, so you're just looking around and you're just like, wow, these just look like ordinary people. And obviously the visitors and the wives and children are mingling amongst the inmates, so it was just difficult to tell who were the good guys and who were the criminals.
It sounds like a kind of a 19th century workhouse, you know, like in England, where you could actually have the families go in and visit and stay with the prisoner once until they got out of debt. But what were the conditions like once you got in there? What did it look like to you?
I mean, there are 8 different sections, and ironically, the prisoners themselves have given each of the sections a star rating, like a hotel star rating. So there's a 5.5 star section where the wealthy politicians and high-level drug traffickers live, and they have, I saw a jacuzzi in one of the cells. One of the inmates had his own library. They had internet. They have a billiard room. They have nice restaurants. And then it goes down to, I stayed in the 4-star section with Thomas, and then in the 0 and 1-star sections, the conditions are absolutely appalling. Sometimes, as you mentioned in your introduction, 2 or 3 or 4 inmates live crammed in one sort of cell, and they call them sarcophagi. That's the
like
name.
A coffin,
like,
right.
A coffin, yeah.
Are there even homeless people in such a place?
One of the other amazing aspects of this prison is that you have to buy your own prison cell. So the government sort of throws you in there, and the guard there, as you said, there are no guards inside the prison. So you really have to fend for yourself. And the prisoners have developed a real estate system. So when you enter as a new prisoner, you actually have to purchase a prison cell. And depending on what your budget is, what your real estate budget is, you can go into the 6-star section or the 5.5-star section or or the one-star section. If you haven't got enough money to buy a prison cell, you can rent one. And if you haven't got enough money to rent, then you're sleeping outside. And it's a really cold city. It's 3,600 meters above sea level. So that's higher than Kosciuszko. You can imagine how cold it gets at night. And there have been a number of cases of inmates dying of exposure.
And is this just kind of accepted in Bolivia as the way it is?
Bolivia is the second poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. So the conditions on the outside are already quite difficult for most Bolivians. And then this is obviously the poorer segment of society that has been, you know, is being neglected and, you know, forgotten, I guess. So once they're, you know, it's the same all over the world. When people go to prison, the society just shuts them out.
I'm always really interested in slums. Slums is, I think they're often misunderstood. I've talked to people about this in the West. They're misportrayed in some ways. Slums, despite their ramshackle nature, are often places of quite vibrant energy here and there. Is this prison like that? Does it have the energy of a slum?
That's exactly what I would describe it as. It's just like a small, a poor village or a slum. And I have spent some time in, they're called comunas in Colombia, and in Brazil they call them favelas.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating because obviously to the outside world, you know, often they're protected by people at the perimeter of the actual suburb, so that outsiders can't come in. But once you're inside and once they accept you, they're really warm, giving people. I mean, obviously there is criminality going on inside, there is sometimes violence, but a real sort of sense of social cohesion amongst people who are extremely poor.
Is there a fair bit of entrepreneurial energy as well?
Absolutely. I mean, the government doesn't give them any money, and it gives them one bowl of watery soup per day as food. So the inmates need to have jobs inside the prison. The most enterprising inmate in my mind was Thomas McFadden, the guy I wrote the book about. He couldn't speak Spanish. So it's very difficult to make money inside a prison if you can't speak the local language. And he started these guided tours, and he would charge people $5 US to come in, and you could actually spend $5 more and stay the night. But apart from the tours, inmates were in there shining boots, washing laundry. They start restaurants. They have photocopying services. There was a doctor who was in prison for stabbing his wife 53 times, and he continued to practice the medical profession. So it was really cheap doctor services, but I wasn't keen to go to him.
No, clearly not. So, Thomas, you tell me about meeting Thomas. What impression you had of him when you were introduced to him as this guide?
Well, I'd been told he was an English drug trafficker who'd been caught, and so my prejudice was I was looking for a white person, and he was actually born in Tanzania. So I walked in, didn't expect him to be dark skinned, and he was the most lovely, gentle, with a sort of really lovely voice, and just really warm person. Shook my hand, said, "Hey, Rusty, how are you doing? It's a lovely name." And, you know, my prejudice, my stereotype is that, you know, the criminal classes are rough and mean and violent. And it just absolutely blew all my sort of prejudices.
So there's a kind of civility, perhaps, that operates in this village-like environment inside the prison that you don't normally find in a prison in a country like Australia, perhaps.
Absolutely. And I think partly that's due to the fact that because the prison is in the centre of La Paz, the inmates don't lose contact with their family and don't lose contact with society. There's a constant flow of visitors going through. Girlfriends and wives can go inside and live inside the prison. They bring their kids in. They can bring in their refrigerator, their television. So they're not completely cut off from society. So that's a very original prison model. Some might say that it's too lax, not enough punishment, but you know, there's a real sense of solidarity, and, you know, it's almost, during the day at least, it's almost like a festive atmosphere.
And what's life like for these children? You see them knocking around and playing about?
That was one of the things I found the most difficult to stomach, because on one hand, if the kids weren't allowed to live in there, they'd probably be on the streets. It's a poor country, so if you send the husband to prison, there's high unemployment. Women tend not to be high income earners. And so that would split the family up, and who knows where the kids would end up. But at the same time, so you see this really loving family relationships, and the kids sleeping inside their father's cell, trotting off to school in school uniform, going out the main gates and with their little backpacks on, and then coming back in the afternoon to do their homework in their father's prison cell. They're extremely protective of the kids in there. One incident I saw was inmates were having an absolute brawl, and then a little kid walked past, and everyone, oh, there's a kid coming, and they froze, and they sort of held their pose, and the kid walked past, completely oblivious to the fact there was, you know, violence occurring right next door, and then the kid went past, and they resumed their beating.
What's life like after dark, though, in this space?
Yeah, it's a very different, it's almost like Jekyll and Hyde kind of change. So as I said, you know, during the day, it's blue skies, Coca-Cola signs on the wall. There are colourfully dressed women in the local garb and restaurants and music. And at nighttime, the wealthier sections close their doors because that's when prisoners begin to consume alcohol and drugs, mainly crack cocaine, or it's actually called base in Bolivia. So, and once you start smoking that, you know, the inmates will end up selling, you know, the clothes off their back and perhaps even becoming violent in order to get money to buy the next hit. So it's a completely different beast at nighttime.
So having gone on this tour with Thomas, you then had the option of spending the night there for another $5. How easy was it to make that decision, Rusty?
Well, I was travelling with my then-girlfriend Simone, and she was the one who suggested it. She suggested we stay inside this prison because Thomas took – there were 15 of us on the tour, and he took three of us back to his prison cell, and we, you know, had a few drinks and got chatting, and then the bell went. I really wanted to hear more of these stories. I was like, I don't want to leave. And then he's like, well, why don't you stay the night? And I was like, stay the night in a prison? What about Simone? And she was like, I'll be fine. And I'm like, this is a, you know, an attractive 24-year-old woman who is volunteering to stay inside a, you know, a fully functional male prison in Bolivia. She was probably more courageous than I was. But we both ended up staying, and there was absolutely no problems whatsoever.
What happened when you got into his cell? Did he offer you any drugs?
Yes, he did. And probably erroneous to call it a cell. These are more like little student dorms because the inmates themselves, they buy their prison cell. They get given the property title deed for their little cell, their little room, and they can furnish it, they can paint it, they can do whatever they want, and there's no curfew. So it really is just like a whole bunch of student rooms in a ramshackle hotel. So we get back to his room, and he just put out a CD case with some lines of cocaine and said, you know, do you want some? And I, just having just graduated from law school, I was like, this is entrapment.
Yeah.
I was thinking the police were going to bust the door down.
So you politely know? Declined?
I declined it first. And yeah. I was like, I don't know you. I think this is a bit dangerous to be doing drugs inside a prison. And, you know, I trusted him, but I'd known him for all of an hour. So I was very, very, very wary of the dangers. In South America, it's quite frequent that travellers get set up with drugs, and then the police, then they have to pay large bribes to get out of prison, even though we're already in prison. So he said, look, this is the safest place, and it's the purest cocaine in the world because it's manufactured inside the prison. And besides, what are they going to do?
Sorry, manufactured inside the prison?
Yeah, I'd say about 80% of the prisoners inside San Pedro are in there for drug offences. So that's all they know. And so once they get inside, they start discussing business, and then they actually bring in the precursors. So basically cocaine has two stages. It goes from the leaf into a paste, and then from the paste into the crystal cocaine that people snort, and it comes in as the paste, and then they refine it because they're experts in drug manufacturing.
And what else are they going to do because they're in prison? Right.
Exactly. And so Thomas said, and besides, what's going to happen if you did get busted doing cocaine? What are they going to do? Put you in prison?
but you can leave. That's the thing, Rusty, in theory. In any case, how long did you end up staying there?
Simone and I stayed two nights. That was the initial visit. At the end of those two nights, I decided, actually Simone persuaded Thomas that I was a good writer and that I should be able to write a really good book for him. And I was like, yeah, this sounds great. And then, of course, we continued our travels. I went back to Sydney, started working in the legal industry. And, of course, it all seemed like a big dream, you know, this sort of crazy two nights inside Bolivian prison and this sort of strange promise to write a book about an English drug trafficker. But I stuck to my passion and I saved up some money and went over there and ended up staying for 4 months.
So what was his story? What was Thomas's story? How did he end up going from Britain to being in this cell in Bolivia?
Yeah, Thomas was born in Tanzania and he was sent to live with his aunt in Liverpool, UK, when he was quite young. And he was not welcome in that family. And so from a very young age, he started, you know, skipping school, looking for a way out of the country, basically. And he took up drug trafficking at a relatively young age, I think 16 or 17. He went to India, he was smuggling heroin, and then the cops were onto him in India, so he decided to switch products and switch continents and started moving cocaine out of Bolivia. He was, you know, he was a guy who wasn't very well educated, who was essentially an opportunist and a survivor.
And charming guy too, clearly. So is that's all he could have to live on, his English language skills and his charm while in this prison.
Absolutely. Like, I think that was the reason that the tours became so popular. You really need to, you know, have your wits about you in a prison. And for people to be able to trust someone within a short period of time, and for that person's reputation to spread amongst an entire travelling community throughout South America. And in fact, his tour's got a write-up in both the Lonely Planet guidebook and the Footprints guidebook. So it was listed as the world's most bizarre tourist attraction. So once it gained that level of legitimacy where guidebooks were kind of recommending or semi-recommending the tourists to go in there, that was, you know, he became quite famous.
How old was he and how far was he into his sentence when you met him?
He was 26 when he was busted, and he was 29 when I met him. And so he had one more year to go on his prison sentence.
Did you like him as a person?
Absolutely. From the get-go, you know, against my prejudices again. You go in there thinking this is a bad person, drugs are bad for society, and so this guy must be, you know, immoral, violent, unethical, mean. And he wasn't at all. He was charming, engaging, friendly, generous, and great fun. Really a great storyteller. And that was really what made me want to stay there. It was just these fascinating stories, which was so far from the reality that I'd grown up with in Mossman in Sydney, and, you know, doing a law degree. So here's a white middle-class lawyer and a black drug trafficker from the wrong side of town sitting in a prison cell in Bolivia talking stories.
So like you say, you went back to Australia for a while and then decided to write his story with him? Was that the idea, to write it together?
Yeah, I mean, initially I thought, look, how long is it going to take to get someone's life story? I mean, you're getting my life story in the space of a half an hour, yeah. An hour. But he, you know, he had a habit of stringing his stories out. And so my initial thought was I'd be there for a week or two, and it ended up being 4 months. And we did it definitely in conjunction with each other. I recorded the interviews on microcassettes, which were still around at that time. This is 2000. And for safety reasons, we didn't want the authorities to realise that we were recording interviews or that we were writing a book. So we convinced them somehow that I was his cousin, which is rather strange.
Well, improbable, I think.
Improbable. Right. And, you know, the Bolivians are very good natured. They're really friendly people. And providing you make them laugh, they'll go along with anything. So we used to sort of say, so how could you, the guards would say, how could you be his cousin? I go, he's the black sheep of the family.
And so once you're recording all this stuff on microcassettes. Mm. How did you get them out?
So I actually rented an apartment on the outside, and I was free to come and go as I pleased. So I'd spend the night in there, and then I could go out during the day and come back, because I wasn't a prisoner. And obviously we didn't want these microcassettes to be found, because they often do searches for drugs and alcohol and weapons. And if they'd found these cassettes, that would have made them suspicious. So I used to take sort of two or three of these cassettes out at a time down my underwear, take them to my safe house, to my apartment, and then there I would transcribe them on using a separate voice recording.
You would have been running into a lot less friendly prisoners than Thomas while you were there. Who were some of the more kind of sinister prisoners you met while you were there?
Probably the one that scared me the most was a guy called Fantasma, which means ghost in Spanish. He was a young guy, I think he was only 19, and he'd shot his best friend in the face with a shotgun, but in public, like in front of multiple witnesses. He had no regard for human life. That was his initial crime. And once he was inside the prison, he killed three more people. And this is a 19, 20-year-old Latino kid who was high on drugs the whole time. I remember when I was in there, he killed a cat just for no reason, just because he could. Proper psychopath. And I strictly avoided him. If I saw him, you know, he might sort of wave to me and I'd just minimise contact. There are some disturbed people in prisons anywhere in the world, but he was a very disturbed individual. And add drugs into the equation, smoking cocaine, and you've got a really volatile mix.
So like you say, it was you're into the last year of Thomas's sentence. Did you have some sort of role to play there in getting him out a bit early?
I did. Well, actually, he was guilty of the first charge, which was he was attempting to smuggle 5 kilograms of cocaine out of Bolivia in the false spines of a suitcase. But inside the prison, he was also doing drugs and selling drugs, but he actually got charged with selling drugs. But that, he claims, at least, that he was innocent of this particular accusation. But he was facing potentially another 10 years in prison. And that would have meant that writing the book might have, you know, been a death sentence for him.
Because, oh, right.
Because one of his friends who was threatening to expose the corruption was found, you know, the guards tortured him and then hung him by his bed sheets to make it look like suicide. So it's a dangerous exercise doing an expose on, you know, the corruption in any country. And if Thomas had continued to be in prison, I probably wouldn't have published the book. So I had to get him out, and so I posed as a human rights lawyer. I went and bought I was like a scruffy backpacker. I had like shoulder length hair. And I pulled my hair back in a little ponytail. Went and bought a really cheap suit and tie and shoes, and turned up to court claiming that I was an international human rights lawyer. And for a while, they were sort of looking at me very. There were three judges. They were looking at me very kind of warily. You know, he didn't look like he was going to get off. So I eventually went and bribed them. I gave them. They asked for $8,000, and I ended up giving them half up front, and I promised them the other half once they let Thomas go. And of course, we didn't have any money. I was a poor backpacker, and so we fled the country.
Oh, right. Wow. So can you ever go back there? Can Thomas ever go back there now?
I went back last year to with Thomas, actually, and to do a documentary called Wildland. So this was sort of 20 years on since Thomas had been busted. And, you know, we went back as, you know, older, more mature men. I don't know if we're that much more mature or wise, but we went back inside the prison, and it was pretty hair-raising because there are a lot of inmates in there who are in there for murder have got 30-year sentences, and they recognised us immediately, even though we're 15 years older than when we were in. And yeah, Rusty, Thomas, and so we went around and sat up on the roof of the prison, sort of reflecting on, wow, this is amazing. 15 years later, and an international bestseller, and all started just on one crazy night in prison.
So 2003, you publish Marching Powder, the story of Thomas and you together in prison, and it becomes a huge bestseller. What did your mum and dad say when they read this and realised what you'd been up to all this time?
Well, they knew I was writing a book, and they knew I was writing a book about a drug trafficker in prison, but they didn't know that I was staying in there. So I think that was probably a wise decision to tell. Mum would have, you know, had a heart attack. But they did read the drafts before it came out, and I think they were just shocked and dismayed. But ultimately, very supportive parents. So, you know, it's not a usual course for a kid to go off and do something like living in a prison, write a book. But my parents have always been extremely supportive of my writing. Dismayed and supportive, I think, is the
dismayed and supportive. Fair enough. I get that. You did survive. You don't have a huge scar on your face,
no. Yeah,
or emotionally either, by the sound of things. What did Thomas think of the book once it was completed?
He loved it. As I said, the day we got out, we left the country and we moved to Colombia, and we lived together for another year or so. And so that was where I actually wrote the first draft in Colombia, and we were living together. So what we would do is I would write the chapter, and then I'd read it aloud to him in the park, and he would say, oh, no, you got that wrong. Oh, that bit's good. No, I didn't say that. No, you got that name wrong. So it was very much I did all the writing, but it was very much a collaborative effort.
Something to be said about reading sentences out loud too, and to see, you can really gauge how engaging the writing is as
a
result,
and you can hear it in your own head, and you can the cadence of the story. I think that's a really good exercise for writers to get the sort of balance in a sentence as well.
So where is Thomas now?
Thomas is now back in Tanzania. So he left Colombia. He went back to the UK for a while. He found that very difficult. He said that London was more awash with cocaine than Colombia.
Oh, my God.
So it was quite difficult because he had been taking drugs for 5 years inside the prison, so it's quite hard to get off once you've been doing drugs that long. And then he found it expensive, and he went back to Tanzania, and he's got two kids. He actually called his son, his firstborn son, Rusty, so it was a great honour.
So he's just living a quiet, pleasant life
in
Tanzania.
He's actually become a chicken farmer. He owns 2,000 chickens. So, I mean, we're not rich from this book at all. He made the promise that he wouldn't go back to trafficking. As I said, he's not highly educated, and he hasn't got professional skills. So he's gone back to being a humble chicken farmer in Tanzania.
At the time, were you hoping it would change things in Bolivia, publishing this book?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up with the belief that when truth comes out, that society will react, and that's all you need to do, and that's all journalists need to do, is to go, look at this, is look at what's going on, and once people know the truth, then actions will be taken to change it. So I genuinely thought, you know, exposing the corruption inside this prison, the drug sales, there was a 12-year-old girl who was found to be pregnant in 2013. She'd been living with her father and uncle inside the prison, and they'd been systematically raping her for 5 years. And the only reason the authorities came out, found out, was because she became pregnant. So a 12-year-old pregnant in a prison. So this kind of horrific abuse stories that go on inside the prison, you'd think society would react and they'd be shut down. In fact, it's business as usual. If anything, for a short time after Marching Powder came out, demand for the prison tours went up. So people, rather than paying $5, were going in there. And I heard of one Australian guy paying $1,000 to spend the night in there because he was such a fan of the book that he went over there and said, I'm not taking no for an answer. Here's $1,000. So unfortunately, Richard, it had, I won't say the opposite effect, but it didn't have the desired effect.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online, and on your mobile.
So, 2003, you're on a plane to Colombia, and you meet this guy while you're on this plane. Tell me about this meeting.
I was in Miami Airport coming into Bogota, and they had a gate change, and they announced it in Spanish, and this gentleman was looking around going, what's going on? And we just started chatting, and we got along fine. I was like, so what are you doing down in Bogota? Because 2003, the economy was not strong. The country has been at war for 45 years at this stage, and kidnapping's rife, and there's very little foreign investment. So I was thinking, he was about in his late 40s. So I was thinking, what is this guy doing going into Colombia? I was a bit suspicious. And he said, oh, I'm in construction. And I said, really? There's not much construction going on. He goes, oh, I'm in construction. And he stuck to his story. We exchanged numbers. In fact, we saw each other after the flight in the airport, and he sort of said, where are you off to? I said, oh, I'm just going to get a cab off the street and go and get a hotel. And he's like, oh, no, let me give you a lift. And he gave me a lift, but in an armoured vehicle, basically, effectively a bulletproof car with a driver. And I was like, this is even more suspicious. Who is this guy? We stayed in contact, email. He flew in and out of the country every now and then, took me out to dinner a few times. I was, at this stage, Marching Powder had not yet taken off, so I was still poor, still had long hair. And eventually he sort of said, well, would you be interested in a job? I said, doing what? And he said, well, get your hair cut, buy some clothes, and I'll pick you up at 6 a.m. And he took me out to a military base that had been constructed.
Yeah, I noticed after you said, what kind of job? He didn't answer that question. No, dodging the haircut in the suit.
Yeah, he right. said, look, I'll show you what we do. And I was like, this sounds really serious. Like I was like, I don't know where I'm going, to my girlfriend at the time. I was like, what if I go missing? but no, he was a really lovely guy, really engaging. Yeah, not secretive, but sort of slightly evasive about what he did. Obviously, because he was working for the US government, he was in charge of the construction and the logistics for various counter-terrorism bases in all the world's hotspots, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Indonesia. And so this is in the wake of September 11, 2001, the attacks in New York. The US government was pumping lots of money into counter-terrorism, and Colombia was one of the countries which was a huge recipient of US aid. So
his line of work then is what were like building compounds, essentially, that are defensible.
What he did was it was a counterterrorism school within a pre-existing military base. So what it involved was a 100-meter shooting range and what's called a shoot house, where they do mock rescues. One of the major problems in Colombia is kidnapping. On average, at its peak, 9 people were being kidnapped per day. I mean, you can imagine if even one person got kidnapped in Australia, it would be headlines. 9 per day, so between 3,000 and 4,000 a year. So that was the focus of this particular program that I was involved in.
And what was the nature of your work?
Well, My first thought was, why me? I've got no military training. This is not my industry. I'm a lawyer, writer. But what they needed someone who they could trust. They needed someone who could speak the language. And they needed someone who had some financial skills. And I'd studied commerce law. And they needed someone who understood the culture and who would keep their mouth shut.
Yeah, and you're also a guy who could stick it out living in a prison in La Paz for day after day after day, week after week as well.
Yeah, it's an exciting, glamorous-sounding job to my mind, but it's probably for most people, it's actually probably quite a hard position to feel if you think about it.
So what was the nature of the job, though? What were you actually doing?
So my job title was program manager, and I was doing the logistics and the camp management and personnel management, financial management for this counterterrorism program, so anti-kidnapping. So we were training and equipping with weapons, uniforms, explosives, det cord, grenades, bullets, the local SWAT teams. There were 32 different provinces in Colombia, and they brought down US soldiers who were the trainers, and they were training up the local special forces to prevent and to effectuate kidnap rescues.
And what kind of security measures did you then have to adopt in order to do that role?
Yeah, so the US embassy in Bogota has very strict rules. I was a subcontractor. I wasn't a direct employee of the government, but they give you a briefing. It's very strict. You aren't allowed to talk on the phone. You're not allowed to tell people where you are on the phone because you're to assume that all telephone communications are intercepted. This is 2003, and we obviously since know who was doing the interception. And you have to live on either the third floor or above because of car bombs. They gave me a bulletproof car to drive around in, but the biggest protection was just keeping my mouth shut, because if you start going around telling people that you work for the US government in a country which has a communist insurgency which hates the US government and was trying to overthrow the local US backed government, you could be putting yourself in danger. And in fact, when I was there were three subcontractors who were captured by the insurgents, and they were kept in the jungle for 7.5 years, not knowing whether they were going to live or die, fed on a diet of rice and lentils and chained by the neck to trees, kept in barbed wire cages. The insurgents' policy is if there is a rescue attempt, they shoot all the hostages. So you can imagine the psychological and emotional trauma of being held hostage. It would be worse than being a prisoner, and hoping that you're going to get rescued, but hoping that if you do get rescued that you don't get shot. And 7.5 years in the jungle, can you imagine how horrific that experience would be? And that were just three people. There were Colombians who were been held for 11 or 12 years, over a decade holding someone, depriving them of their liberty. And so this particular program aimed to end that. Obviously, in combination with other efforts by the Colombian government, it was a big change of government in 2002, more right-wing government, and they just took the war back to the insurgents. And kidnapping is now down to about one person per day. It's still one too many, but it's certainly a huge change.
Can you just briefly sketch out the kind of terrain here in Colombia, who the various the factions are between the guerrillas on the one hand and the paramilitaries on the other? Mm.
Colombia's a relatively small country up in the northwestern corner of South America. It's actually a very wealthy country in terms of natural resources, but the wealth is maldistributed. There's effectively been a ruling class there until the last 20 or 30 years. They'd never had a middle class. So basically you have peasant subsistent farmers and a ruling class that didn't really care about them, and huge amounts of social injustice and corruption. In the mid-1960s, the peasants began an uprising, and they formed the communist guerrilla known as the FARC. And their aim was to topple the central government and install communism. And then around about the late 70s, the landowners reacted against that because the guerrilla, what they were doing is they were forcibly evicting people from the land, kidnapping and extorting. And so the landowners are like, well, government, what are you doing? Why isn't the army and the police protecting us? So they formed their own private militias, and they're known as the paramilitaries, or right-wing death squads, they're often called. And bit by bit, all these small paramilitary units began to unite, and they became the United Self-Defense Organization of Colombia, which was another terrorist organization.
So what happened as the years went by? How did these organizations evolve? And how far did they start to drift away from what their stated political purposes were?
It's a really good question, Richard. So in both instances, they both claim to be patriotic organisations, social do-gooders. They're doing it for, you know, for their country. The communists were rallying against injustice and maldistribution of wealth. But in the 45 or 50 years of war, not once did they give much back to the Colombian people. And they really, unfortunately, the means became the end. They started using kidnapping, extortion, and ultimately cocaine trafficking as a means of financing this revolution. And of course, their enemy, the paramilitaries, started off with a high moral stance that we are fighting against extortion, kidnapping, and cocaine trafficking. But bit by bit, they began to imitate and emulate their enemy, and they also became deeply involved in criminal activities.
So they eventually just devolved into what, armies of gangsters?
Look, they are, to my mind, they're effectively, you know, large-scale criminal organisations. Basically, ultimately, they became almost like drug cartels with a political raison d'etre. But supposedly, you know, we're fighting for this, but, you know, they were turning over hundreds of millions of dollars.
So then you throw all of this, these other complicating factors, which is the US government's got a clear interest in one side winning as opposed to the other side, and then there's the drug trade and all the complications that come from that. So with all those factors at play, tell me how you became alerted to the issue of child soldiers in Colombia, because this is the subject of your book.
That's right. When people think of child soldiers, they usually think of Africa, and very few people are aware that Colombia, at the peak of the war, had the second highest number of child soldiers in the world, I think after Sudan. And I was just amazed, firstly, that there were so many women in these terrorist organizations. About 30 and 35% of the combatants are women, and about 30% to 35% are children under the age of 18.
30 to 35%.
Yeah, it's difficult. Obviously, it's very difficult to get accurate statistics because, you know, the terrorist organisations don't tend to fill out their censuses.
Typically, how are children drawn into these organisations?
Unlike the African conflicts, they're not usually forcibly recruited. As I said before, the rural Colombia is extremely poor. They have large families. If the father of the or the breadwinner of the family is killed or abandons his family, then you've got these kids who are hungry, and these armed organizations effectively have control over the entire area. The government, the central government, was just not present in these areas. There's no army, no police, no judge, no, you know, garbage collection. And so these organizations became the de facto law, the de facto
government. Quasi-governments.
Quasi-governments, right. Yeah, exactly. And so with very high unemployment, very few prospects, no education, that was, in the case of the paramilitaries, it was a job. They received a salary, a minimal salary. And in the case of the FARC communist guerrillas, it was, in some cases, just a meal ticket. Or they convinced them that if they joined up, they were fighting for a better and more just society. But once they joined up, they couldn't leave, and the penalty for desertion is death.
How young are they bringing them in?
The youngest I heard of was 8 years old, but generally it wasn't the age they were concerned about. It was whether they could carry a rifle and a backpack.
Well, so a kid can't do that at 8.
No, so the 8-year-old kid was brought in, and they were used to sweep the camp and do, you know, basically kitchen duties and until the age where they could carry fire a rifle and carry a backpack.
Can villagers, can people, children, adults, stand aside from this conflict? Is there any way you can just let it go around your village, or is the village inevitably brought into this conflict?
Absolutely, and this is the horror of a civil war, that you have the majority of Colombians are really friendly, hospitable, welcoming, passionate, lovely people, peace loving. And they want nothing to do with drugs.
These gangsters, it's like Northern Ireland, these gangsters are forcing a series of hard choices on everyday people. Is that what's happening?
Exactly. And they utilise the civilian population as a tool to, you know, to send messages to their enemy. And effectively, you don't often have a choice because you are living under, you know, the rule of these particular organisations that control every aspect of local life, including the economy, including wage rates, including how people dress. At one stage, they decreed homosexuality to be illegal. You can get killed for taking drugs, which was obviously a big irony because they were huge drug traffickers themselves. But if you consume drugs, then you'd get killed by them. So it's very, very difficult to maintain neutrality in a country like Colombia, because eventually your life will intersect with one or other of these groups.
How has drug use in the West, therefore funneling money down to this part of the world, how has that been able to sustain this war? Has that had a big role in sustaining this conflict, perhaps long past a point where it would otherwise have petered out?
Absolutely. And, you know, as we said before, it started with a political motivation. I believe when these organisations first started, they really believed in their political cause, that they were doing, in at least in their own minds, that they were doing something positive for their country. But the means became the end. And long after the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, the communist insurgency continued to grow. And to my mind, that was the result of the fact that they were extremely well financed through cocaine trafficking, kidnapping, and extortion.
Has it changed your view on the ethics of Westerners consuming cocaine?
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that I really wanted people to think about when they read this book is, you know, we as Westerners, and I think Australia is now amongst the top five per capita consumers of cocaine in the world. And to my mind, we have two choices. Either once we realise that our Western habits, which we believe on a Friday night is just a bit of fun, a bit of a laugh, like having a few beers, actually is going to funding cartels in Mexico, terrorist organisations in Colombia, I think we have a responsibility to either stop taking cocaine or to put on the table the possibility of legalization, because the war on drugs, which has been raging since 1971 when Nixon declared war on drugs, has not been effective. Drugs are still getting out. There's evidence that more drugs are being consumed than ever. The United States right now is in the midst of a massive opioid epidemic. The number of deaths in the US have quadrupled in the last 3 years from heroin. Colombia also being a producer of heroin.
It seems like the larger part of the thing that's driving here, this issue, is the big, big gaping price differential between what Westerners pay for a gram of cocaine and how much it costs to actually manufacture it in these countries.
Absolutely. So a gram of cocaine in Colombia could be produced for around $2, and if you take into account underweighting and, you know, impurities in Australia, it might go for around $600. So there are no other products on planet Earth that have that profit margin. Obviously, the profit margin comes from the risk and the fact that it's highly criminalized. But the more you criminalize, the more you go after these industries, the higher the price. And therefore, the more lucrative it is for criminal and terrorist organizations to become involved.
So, Rusty, you met a kid called Leo in Colombia. What was his story?
This was one of the most tragic and, at the same time, uplifting stories I've ever heard. Leo was abandoned by his parents. He was effectively an orphan. He was made a ward of the state. And you can imagine, in a developing nation, the quality of orphanages. Along came one of the left-wing terrorist organizations, shot the minders of the kids and took all the kids.
Shot all the people in the child minding centre? Is that what you're saying?
No, it was an orphanage out in the countryside.
In the orphanage itself,
yeah,
they
shot
all the people
teachers,
in the orphanage.
Shot the adults.
Right,
shot the adults and
stole the children.
Stole the children. And then he was only 9 or 10 at that stage, and he was put to work in the coca fields. Children are often used as, they call them raspachines, coca leaf pickers, because they've got, you know, sort of small, nimble fingers. He was too young to carry a backpack and fire a rifle, so he was used as a coca leaf picker. Once he was big enough and strong enough, then he was given military training. He deserted that group and defected to another, because if you desert, they'll come after you. And the only way to flee effectively is to change organizations. So he actually changed terrorist organizations, eventually was captured by the government, went into a demobilization program, then after a year found himself unemployed, and then joined the opposing, like the right-wing terrorist organization for another year. So he'd been an orphan and he'd been kidnapped, he'd been a coca leaf picker, and he'd been in three different terrorist organizations. And when I met him, he was 18 or 19, and he was just the most amazing, well-balanced, positive, optimistic kid. Considering these horrific experiences and this amazing life.
So, Rusty, how had he been brought out of that life?
The way I met him was through one of the government demobilization programs. So when the kids come out of the war, either if they desert or if they're captured by the army, because they're under 18, they can't be sent to prison, they're only children. So the government gives them psychological counselling and food and accommodation and education. So that was my in there. That was how I started to interview him.
These are like rehabilitation centres, are they?
Yeah, there are the government's involved in rehabilitating and re-socialising the children, but there are also a number of local small charities that are also funded, you know, by donations that supplement the government programs effectively. It is obviously primarily the government's responsibility to look after these kids, but often sometimes they don't have the adequate resources or skills to help the kids, and so there's lots of areas where private charities can pick up the slack.
You have a house in Colombia, or you had one. What have you done with this house?
Yeah, I mean, as I was interviewing these kids, and my heart went out to them, I thought, your question before about marching powder, did it make a difference? And I thought, no, it didn't. You know, what could I have done to have actually made a difference, not just writing about it, because that's not enough. Not enough just to bring it to the world's attention. So I, at the moment, my house in Bogota is the head office of one of these local charities that helps children who have been either involved in the war or who are in danger of being recruited into terrorist organizations or street gangs or cartels. And, yeah, 10% of the royalties from this book will go towards helping children affected by violence in Colombia. And I think, you know, people can make a difference. And when people are aware of the problems that are going on outside of their own purview, outside of their own countries, people want to make a difference, and people can make a difference.
You mentioned there that there's a new government, there's fewer kidnappings now in Colombia. I'm sort of vaguely familiar there's been some kind of peace process and a disarmament of the guerrilla movement. Is there less violence as a result of all that?
Officially, the war is over. In fact, the president of Colombia won the Nobel Peace Prize this year for having brought the war to an end officially. The communist insurgency, the leaders have signed a peace pact and they've handed their weapons in just last month, actually. And prior to that, the right-wing paramilitaries also signed a peace pact. So officially, the war is over. Let's wait and see whether or not, you know, there's still a lot of illegal activity, still a lot of cocaine trafficking, and still a lot of weapons floating around in Colombia. So let's hope that the peace sticks. It's certainly a lot safer country than it was 20 years ago. It's an amazing country. Colombians are such lovely, fun people. It's a great country. It's so much safer to visit than it was, you know, 10, 20 years ago.
How are you doing anyway? You've been living in South America in various really interesting places for the last, nearly 20 years now, isn't it? Mm. Or thereabouts, we're getting close to it. How are you going? Where do you live now? What's your life like?
This book took me around 10 years to write, and I was, you know, I couldn't afford to live in Sydney, basically. It's just too expensive for a writer.
What, so even after you published Marching Powder, even after that?
Yeah, it did well, but I mean, it has been, you know, it's
10
been,
years, right,
it's yeah. been 14 years oh. since Marching Powder came out, and so I've just been travelling around, living in developing nations, you know, exploring the world. I love travelling. I love writing. So effectively, the royalties from my first book allowed me to, you know, enough money to keep doing what I love doing. I'm now 42, and I would love to buy a house, but it's pretty prohibitively expensive anywhere in Australia these days. So
hasn't Brad Pitt bought the film rights for Marching Powder?
Yeah, he bought what's called the option. So the option is the right, but not the obligation to make it. So you don't actually necessarily get lots of money if and when that gets made.
It'd be kind of wild to see Brad Pitt playing you, Rusty, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be kind of wild if that would ever happen? I know he doesn't always do that.
No, it was his production company that bought it. I was 25 at the time I met Thomas, so I don't know if he could play a 25-year-old anymore. Handsome guy that he is.
Oh, this is completely fascinating. How great to speak with you about this, Rusty. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard. It's been fantastic.
Rusty Young is the author of Colombiano and Marching Powder. abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.